Welcome back, everyone, to 1001 Ghost, Chiller, and Lovecraft Stories. This is your host, John Hagedorn. Get ready for two great Orson Welles episodes of The Black Museum, what he terms as London's Mausoleum of Death. And now, our show.
This is Orson Welles, speaking from London. The Black Museum, the famous repository of death. Here in the grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, is a warehouse of homicide, where everyday objects, an earthenware pot, a silver shilling, a typewriter ribbon, all are touched by murder. Four small bottles. Other familiar objects, medicine bottles, shining glass, cork stoppered, the labels in neat, clear handwriting. Such bottles are in the medicine cabinet of almost every home. But these were found...
Found one, Inspector. 2 ounce size.
The others can't be far.
Yes, here are two more. 1 ounce capacity, these. And here's the fourth. Innocent little things, aren't they, sir?
Well, today, those four small bottles have a place, a very honored place, in the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death, the Black Museum.
Well, here we are, Black Museum, Scotland Yard's Museum of Murder. Yes, here lies death. In these hundreds and hundreds of objects, large and small, is the means to death, a thousand methods of killing, all neatly labeled to indicate who and what and where and when. Here's a kitchen mop, long handle, it's gray with use, gray where the red-brown stain fails to cover the grayness. Look closely at the harsh metal binds the strings of this utensil. Yes, this blade struck and struck again before the mop itself removed the traces of the crime. Here we are. Here are the four small bottles. Three of 1 ounce capacity. One holds 2 ounces. They mark a strange story. A story out of the Edwardian era, when man was still lord of all he surveyed and women were just beginning to demand equality.
To the ladies, Reverend. Although I would prefer toasting them in something slightly stronger than tea.
To the ladies, my friend.
To listen to my husband, Reverend, who think he was old-fashioned and not an advanced thinker for this age.
I, an advanced thinker? Why, Anne, my dear.
But you are, Oscar. You really are.
At the risk of shocking you, Reverend, but then you're a young man and not, I assume, as easily shocked as some pastors I've known, I believe a man should have two wives.
Really, sir?
He means it, Reverend. Listen to him.
I believe a man needs two wives, one to cook, sew, and care for the household. The other, to be a companion when a man needs intellectual stimulation, to lend beauty to the drawing room, and grace and wit.
Then you would give the latter education.
Exactly. And since I am not allowed two wives, I chose the latter. You're new here, Reverend. You don't know that I married Anne when she was very young and sent her to Brussels and then a French university for her education before installing her here as my wife.
Why? Why, that's unheard of, sir. You are a pioneer in the field, Mr.
Oh, yes. Mr. Oscar Stone, wholesale grocer and a man of means, was truly advanced for his age, the age of 99, and very liberal in his philosophies. In fact, he was so considerate of his wife and of the difference between her age and his own that he encouraged rather than looked askance at her companionship with the Reverend Edgar Sweet, a much, much younger man than Mr. Stone himself.
Edgar... You've been a good friend to me these past months.
I'm happy to hear you say so, Anne.
That is why, well, I'm not hesitating to tell you something which I feel is rather unfair.
Tell me what it is.
Oscar has drawn his will.
Oh, he's my friend, my good friend. I'd hate to see him pass on, but every man must have his house in order.
Edgar, you don't understand. Making the will is all right. It's what he's put in it.
Go on, my dear.
He has left me his entire estate, provided I never marry again.
That is his right, you know.
It's not his right. He's afraid someone might marry me after he's gone. For the money.
He's only protecting you from fortune hunters, Anne.
Then why did he give me an education if he doesn't think enough of me to let me protect myself?
A serpent in Eden? Perhaps. Perhaps not. But it is clear that the young lady had a will of her own and wanted to control her own destiny. In any case, the friendship ripened, not only between the two young people, but between Edgar and Oscar as well.
Edgar, my friend, I'm not well. I saw a doctor today, and I am not well.
I can't believe it. You look fine, fine.
The debilitation of age.
But you're not old. Well, 55 isn't old.
When you worked as hard as I have for almost 50 of those 55 years. Well, in any case, I've decided to take a rest.
Excellent, Oscar. That's what you need, an extended vacation.
I've made arrangements to go to the shore. A month at the sea ought to practically, well, rejuvenate me.
I'll miss you. Our talks have been a great stimulus to my work.
And I thought that, well, even pastors have vacations occasionally.
Occasionally we do.
Of course. So I reserved accommodations for you, along with Anne and myself.
But I can't possibly afford...
As my guest.
You don't know how much I appreciate this, Oscar, but I couldn't accept this.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were alone, Oscar.
I'm glad you came in, Andy. I was telling Edgar we're going to the shore for a month.
Oh, Oscar, how nice.
I'm insisting that Edgar come along as my guest.
How can I accept such an invitation?
Tell him you will find him as welcome as I will, Anne.
Of course I'll find him welcome, Oscar. Edgar knows that.
They compromised. Edgar came for weekends. The ripening of a friendship. Or the growth of a triangle. A classic triangle. Husband, wife, and the young man. The summer ended. Oscar and Anne returned to new lodgings in Pimlico, and they took an additional room.
Edgar, you like it?
Bookcases, a couch, a fine desk, all this room. How could I help liking it?
And in here, right next door.
Edgar, my boy, welcome to your new lodgings. Now, we are not only friends, we are neighbors.
Really, Oscar, I don't know why you...
But there was more, and rather interesting. One afternoon, while Oscar was at his doctor's office...
May I disturb you for a moment, Edgar?
Oh, of course, Anne. What is it?
Remember, months ago, I told you about Oscar's will.
Oh, yes, I remember. Why?
He took out that awful clause. If I want to, I can marry anyone I please one day. And you were the executor.
Everything was quite smooth. Quite smooth. In fact, Oscar began to feel quite a bit better. At least he said so, and insisted that Edgar and Anne accompany him to a horse show.
Why do you love horses so, Oscar?
Perhaps because I always wanted to ride and never learned. Oh, there's a fine animal.
He must be at least 16 hands high.
Edgar, why don't you take Anne to the stalls to see her favorites? I'll just sit here a while. I guess I'm not as strong as I thought I was.
Will you, Edgar, please?
You think you'll be all right here alone, Oscar?
It's a picture, isn't it? The elderly husband sitting on the bench watching the two young people stroll away. What are his thoughts as he sees them disappear in the crowd? What would his thoughts have been if he'd heard their conversation?
I'm dreadfully worried about Oscar.
He seems much better. Seashore did him good.
Seems is the word. He's not. Not really.
Anne, what are you telling me?
That his doctor has confided to me. Oscar may not live out the year.
The next morning there were signs that Anne's words might become the truth. She sent for the doctor, a youngish man named Richards, who lived some half a mile from the lodgings.
I don't like this, Mrs. Stone, not at all.
Oh, dear.
You stop frightening my wife, young man.
The truth, sir, is the truth. You're not well. Your stomach's in very bad shape. Now I shall prescribe for you, and your wife will see that you take your medicine, won't you, Mrs. Stone?
Oh, of course, doctor.
The young doctor was very certain, but not Oscar. His pain continued. Anne was obviously very upset. She took Edgar aside.
Edgar, I want you to do something for me.
If I can.
I cannot see Oscar suffer the way he does at times. I know a way to ease his pain, but I need your help.
Of course.
I want you to buy me some chloroform.
Chloroform?
Yes. A few drops on a handkerchief and he will sleep easily. I learned about it in the practical nursing classes in Brussels.
But Dr. Richards will get you some.
No. He'll never believe I know how to use it. Here's a pound note. Please, Edgar.
Edgar went to the nearest chemist shop.
What can I do for you, Reverend?
I'd like a little chloroform.
Whatever for, sir?
I understand it's good for taking out grease spots.
Oh, yes, I suppose it is. But be very careful with it, sir.
Three more times, Edgar walked into chemist shops and bought a small amount of chloroform. There are the 3 1-ounce bottles and the 1 2-ounce bottle. Out of consideration for Anne's convenience, no doubt, Edgar poured the contents of all the small bottles into a larger one and delivered the chloroform to Anne. Quite suddenly, Oscar became a whole lot better.
Landlord, I want to speak with the landlord.
Yes, Mr. Stone? How can I help you?
I want to prepare a surprise for my wife and the Reverend for tonight.
Yes, sir.
A New Year's Eve party. Some roast duck, a bit of cold ham, some good cheese, a bottle of champagne, and a bottle of good brandy.
It's short notice, Mr. Stone. But I'll do my best. What'll you be eating?
What everyone else eats. And will they be surprised? Oh, I'm feeling wonderful for the first time in months. And for breakfast tomorrow, see if your maid can find a haddock, a large one. Oh, I feel I shall be quite hungry in the morning.
Oscar wasn't hungry New Year's morning. Oscar was dead. And today, the 4 small bottles which played so large a part in his death can be seen in the Black Museum. It was a sad New Year's Day for Anne Stone and a bewildering day for the Reverend Edgar Sweet. Oscar Stone, husband and friend, lay dead quite suddenly, and after what seemed an indicated quick recovery. But that was only the first event of January 1st, 1910. Onto the scene strode an old man, Oscar's 75-year-old father. Anne met him at the door to the Stone apartment.
Oh, father. Father.
Yes, of course. So cry all you want. I want to see my son.
He's in here, father.
All right. Who is this?
Reverend Sweet, our good friend and pastor.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I heard about you. Oscar wrote me.
This moment comes to all of us, sir. We can only pray for courage.
I've got courage. What I want is facts. I'll see my boy now. It looks as if he died in his sleep.
He did. So peacefully. I didn't realize it until morning.
You were a good boy, Oscar. I shouldn't be outliving you. Funny smell around his mouth.
But the doctor said he had gastritis, father.
That's not what I smell. Are you having a post-mortem?
Dr. Richards asked for permission to do one.
Richards? Who's he?
The family doctor, Mr. Stone, a fine young man.
All right, if he wants to do it, all right, but I want my man there with him.
Father, are you insinuating?
I'm not insinuating anything. I just don't like the look of this. For his own protection, this Richards ought to have another man present, that's all. My boy's no right.
The second doctor arrived, and forthwith, behind locked doors, the autopsy was performed. In the landlord's parlor, Anne waited, with Edgar to give her support and courage. Presently the door opened.
Mrs. Stone.
Yes, Dr. Richards.
We are ready with our report.
Did you find out anything?
We are not certain as yet. Dr. Fletcher, your father-in-law's man, suggests Mr. Stone swallowed chloroform.
Chloroform?
Yes. Will you come upstairs and hear the report, please?
Anne?
Yes?
Did you... the chloroform I bought for you, that is...
It's still in its bottle, Edgar. Don't worry, you don't even have to mention it. Shall we go upstairs now?
The two young people went upstairs, but not hand in hand. There was a sudden reserve between them. In the room where the doctors nor Mr. Stone awaited them.
This is Dr. Fletcher, my daughter-in-law, and Pastor Sweet.
How do you do?
As Dr. Richards was in charge of the case, perhaps he's the one to give you our official report.
Oh, please do, Dr. Richards.
It's a simple report. We are unable to find any natural cause of death. The contents of the stomach are suspicious. We're holding them for the coroner.
Have you any particular suspicions, gentlemen?
None which we care to state officially.
You realize the room where death occurred must be sealed and its contents must not be touched.
Oh, my purse is in there.
It'll have to stay there.
Well, surely I may have my coat and a hat.
I assume so. If Dr. Fletcher's present when you remove them.
Anne went to stay with a cousin, a brief train journey away. The coroner's inquest was held and adjourned, pending a full report from a government analyst. That was all. But Edgar dispatched a note to Anne, and she met him, as he requested, in a quiet tea room in Pimlico.
Edgar, what's the matter with you? You haven't looked me straight in the eye since we met today.
I can't seem to help myself. Anne, Dr. Richards did tell you that Oscar might not live out the year.
Well, of course he did.
It came so suddenly. They all behaved so strangely. And I'm afraid I'm finished. If this develops into anything, I shall lose my pulpit.
If you don't do anything foolish, I certainly won't.
Everything's going wrong. I feel as if... Anne, I bought that chloroform. If there is chloroform in the autopsy report... Anne, don't you see?
Oh, forget the chloroform. Forget all about it.
I can't. Where is it? What did you do with it?
I took it with me when I left the apartment. Right in my coat pocket, under the nose of my dear father-in-law. I poured it out of the train window. Then I threw the bottle away.
Oh, that makes it worse. If they prove that Oscar was... Don't you see? They'll trace the chloroform to me.
In other words, Edgar... You're implying that I gave it to Oscar.
I'm not implying anything of the kind.
What else are you saying? Edgar, you helped me over a bad time. Now I think it will be best if we do not see each other anymore. Goodbye, Edgar.
The lady was annoyed, perhaps rightly so. The young man was frightened, very rightly so. In their separate ways, each awaited the report of the government analyst. At long last, Dr. Richards came to the young widow.
The news could be a lot worse, Mrs. Stone. They could have found arsenic or one of the slower, more common poisons.
What have they found, Doctor?
Poisoning by chloroform.
Oh, Doctor, that is the worst.
How so? Don't tell me you had some in your possession.
I did. I had my reasons. Doctor, my married life was not happy. I am young. He was old. Practically my father. He kept putting me... In Edgar's company, I began to... When two people are together constantly, I...
Please go on, Mrs. Stone.
I obtained the chloroform. I kept it in a drawer. But I'd never had a secret from Oscar. Never, on any score. So, on New Year's Eve after our party, I told him I had it and where it was. He spoke to me sadly, but kindly... Grieved that I'd been feeling about him as I did. Then he went to sleep. Or I thought he did. The next I knew, he was dead.
Did you look at the bottle?
Yes, I couldn't tell how much was gone. I took the bottle and I poured what was in it from the train as I went.
The autopsy report came to Edgar as well. He wrestled with himself and finally... took the only course which seemed open.
Inspector Seward?
Yes, come in, sir. Sit down.
Thank you.
I understand you have some information in the matter of the death of Oscar Stone.
I do. You see, I bought the chloroform.
They should be in here somewhere, Sergeant.
If the little parson is telling the truth.
I'm sure he is. He'll let himself in for something with that woman, didn't he?
It looks that way. Leave it to a woman every time.
Grease spots, eh? Not bad for an amateur. I suppose this is the gorse patch where you said he threw those small bottles.
Yes, this is the place. I found one, Inspector. 2 ounce size.
The others can't be far.
Yes, here are two more.
1 ounce capacity, these.
And here's the fourth. Innocent little things, aren't they, sir?
Anne Stone, I have a warrant for your arrest on the charge of willful murder of your husband.
Edgar Sweet, I have a warrant for your arrest. You stand charged as an accessory before the fact in the murder of Oscar Stone.
The trial took place at the next assizes.
Gentlemen of the jury, the Attorney General, who has this case in hand, with full knowledge of the facts, will present no evidence against the Reverend Mr. Sweet. You are therefore directed to find him not guilty, and I shall order his release at once.
Edgar Sweet left the courtroom, a much wiser young man. The trial of Anne Stone proceeded and rested entirely on the medical evidence.
Dr. Fletcher, you have described yourself as an expert in criminal toxicology. We have accepted you as such. Is that correct?
It is, sir.
Very well. Now, I call the particular attention of the jury to the answers you will give to these questions, as they will have great bearing on the evidence against my client. First, sir, have you ever known of a recorded case of murder by liquid chloroform?
No.
Is there any record, to your knowledge, of the forcible administration of this liquid, of anyone pouring it down a victim's throat?
There is not.
If the victim were sleeping, for instance...
The burning would waken him. It would probably go down his windpipe, not his gullet.
And there would be burns, clearly visible after death.
There would be.
Then, in your expert opinion, Dr. Fletcher, is it impossible to commit murder by liquid chloroform?
Nothing's impossible, but it's highly improbable.
Thank you, Doctor. That is all.
The chief witness of the Crown, Dr. Fletcher, had given his testimony. All that remained, in the opinion of the defending counsel, was to create a reasonable doubt in the minds of the jury. He called no witnesses, but spoke for 6 hours, summing up. In essence, he said...
Oscar Stone was a loving, if elderly, husband. He felt his life was over. Remember, he was an eccentric who believed in having 2 wives. Can we say that this man, who had given so much to his sweet young wife, was not prepared to give her the greatest gift of all, her freedom? Once he knew that chloroform was in the house, could he not have taken it himself and passed quickly into the coma which ended in death? And if he gave this lovely girl freedom, are you, who sit in judgment, to do any less?
The judge was clear, if somewhat caustic, in his charge to the jury.
There have been sweet faces which hid guilty consciences before. When a young wife and a young man are thrust into daily contact by a doting husband, strange events have a way of taking place. All this is true, but one salient remains. You may find this woman guilty as charged only if no reasonable doubt exists in your minds that she did commit the crime of which she stands.
The jury deliberated for over 2 hours. They were 12 solemn men when they filed back into the jury box. Anne Stone rose to face them. The clerk asked for the verdict. The foreman rose and spoke clearly.
We have considered the grave suspicions in this case, but find no evidence that would indicate who administered the poison to the victim. We find the accused, therefore, not guilty.
But despite that perhaps surprising verdict of not guilty, the 4 famous small bottles can be seen today in the Black Museum.
Orson Welles will be back with you in just a moment.
No double jeopardy. That's an ancient English law, no double jeopardy. One cannot be tried twice for the same offense. It was felt, therefore, that since Anne Stone had been acquitted, if she had committed this crime, she ought to tell the world how it had been done. But no. All that was heard thereafter from Anne Stone was a letter addressed to her defending counsel. It read as follows. Dear Sir Edward, I feel I owe my life to your earnest effort. I have not been a good woman, and my temptations have been terrible. But though I have not kept my vows, you will judge me mercifully. And there the case rests. Now, until we meet next time, in the same place, and I tell you another story about the Black Museum, I remain, as always, obediently yours. This is Orson Welles, speaking from London. The Black Museum. Here in the grim stone structure on the Thames, which houses Scotland Yard, is a warehouse of homicide. A warehouse where a parchment lampshade, an automobile tire, a canvas tarpaulin, an umbrella, all are touched by murder. And here's a dictionary. It's a familiar object. French into English, English into French. Every high school student knows what these books are like. Word here, phrase there. Merci, thank you, thank you, merci. And of course, a use common to most young men in countries not their own.
Je t'aime. Je t'aime.
Oh, you sound so... How passionate, Jewel. What does that mean?
In the little book, one moment. Je t'aime, I love you.
Well, today the dictionary can be seen in the Black Museum.
From the annals of the Criminal Investigation Department of the London Police, we bring you the dramatic stories of the crimes recorded by the objects in Scotland Yard's Gallery of Death, the Black Museum.
Museum of Murder. Not a very pleasant place, but it's interesting. Yes, here lies death. The people who conceived this place must have wished to raise a memorial for death. And here, collected under one roof, are the mementos of murder from over 100 years. Here's a dart, a feathered dart, made for pleasure, for laughter and friendly tavern. This tiny metal tip was dipped in cyanide. A twist of a wrist, flick of an elbow, a dartboard missed, spectator was scratched, it was murder. Ah, here we are, the dictionary. You want the English for a French word? It is, or the French for a word in English, it's here also. Nice idea, all in one book, great convenience. Particularly for Jules Gamache, who had a bit of trouble expressing himself to Betty Brown on the beach in southern France. One warm and sunny afternoon.
Je t'aime. Je t'aime.
Oh, you sound so passionate, Jewel. What does that mean?
In the little book, one moment. Je t'aime. Oui. I love you.
Right, Jewel. A married woman?
It was.
love out of a dictionary in the summer in southern France. Of course, this was in 1923. That date's important simply because radio and broadcasting were just beginning. And Jules Gamache was something of an electrical engineer. In fact, he was the only man in the little French seaside town who was able to bring music out of the air.
Luc Galen, le... Oh, how you say in anglais? Ah, the cat's whisker. So. Maintenant, ma chérie, écoutez.
Oh, Jules. But there really is music in his funny rubber ear now.
Huh?
Why, Jules, well, you are bright, aren't you?
I love you. I must have you now, today. Parbleu, always.
Oh, Jules.
A clever Frenchman who knew his way about with women. An Englishwoman vacationing in France. Why was she there?
Oh, Jules, if I were a better manager, if we'd be better with the inn, well, I'd never have had the breakdown. I'd never have come to France, and I'd never have met you and you and your... you and your mom, Miss Claire.
Oh, so that was it. But all such items come to an end someday. And summer comes to an end, at least that's the correct calculation. That's the way Betty calculated, without thinking of her Jules.
Jules?
Oui, ma chérie?
I have to go home.
Oui. Et je viens. I come also.
Oh, Jules, that's impossible.
However, the usual sighs and protestations, of course. It was just a brief interlude, Betty was a trifle saddened to let it go. After all, when a woman is crowding 40, she went home anyway to Sussex, to the Binnacle Inn, to security of sorts, and to her husband, Al.
Business hasn't been too bad while you were away, Bessie. All the rooms were let this week, and the bar trade was fine.
I dare say you did all right by the bar.
The landlord's got to be social, girl. Otherwise, his customers go somewhere else.
There's a difference, Alf, between social and drunk.
Here, now, none of that. I take a drop now and then, but I don't get drunk. Well, another customer. Business is picking up, and on the hotel side of that.
Oh.
How can I help you, sir?
One moment, please. I will find the word. I have come to stay.
What do you know? A froggy. Pleased to have you, Monsieur. May I ask how you found us?
Monsieur Brown, the merveilleuse Madame Brown is the recommendation for your so select hotel. Is it not so that we have met in Provence, Madame?
The little Frenchman must have been mad. Mad with love. Or just a little touched in the head. In any case, he'd come just as he said, to stay. As he explained it to Al Brown.
I am, an inventor. I have much great ideas.
Yes, sure, Gamma, sure. But do you make any money?
To make money? Je ne comprends pas.
Money, shillings, francs.
Beaucoup d'argent. Oh, right now I wake from Canada. Much money.
And what do you invent to get all this boku money?
The wireless. I am in the wireless very much interested.
Well, Monsieur, if you can get music out of the air, maybe you can get some money out of the same place to pay what you owe us.
Huh?
You've been here a month now, and we haven't seen a shilling on your board bill.
Board bill? Comment?
There was another conversation shortly thereafter on the same subject, if not exactly on the same polite level.
Look, Bessie, he's your friend. We've got to have some money.
How can I ask him for money, even if he is our friend?
Yours, not mine. He doesn't take walks with me every afternoon.
Alf Brown, are you suggesting?
I'm not suggesting, dearie. I'm telling you. Get some money out of him or out he goes. You're supposed to be the business head in this family. All right. Tend to business here.
Well, you never talked to me like this before.
It was the first time for everything, they say. For the first time, Al was in the driver's seat and he knew it. So did Betty know it. On one of their afternoon walks, she said as much to Jules.
do?
Oui, ma chérie.
After sex.
Oh, he will do nothing, jamais.
He's after me.
Hein?
To get money from you. What are you laughing at? I'm telling you, that will be real nasty. Me throw us both out, and you without a penny. Well, it's not funny. He holds the whip hand. Don't you understand?
Oui, one moment.
Oh, Jew. Not that little book again.
Oui, certainement, le petit livre. Ici, I have it. Like an Englishman, so... Ah, one may steal his wife, but not owe to him money.
Jules was self-confident, to say the least. He behaved as if he had a plan. He said to Al,
never fear, mon ami. In a few days, beaucoup d'argent. You like? Oui?
To Betty, he said,
je t'aime, ma chérie. Do not fear. All will be well.
A quiet, dull New Year's morning. The routine of the inn continued, minus the overtired, oversleeping maid. After a while, the master came grumbling down the stairs.
Bessie! Bessie, where are you?
Ah, please. I think Mr. Gamache is dead.
Well, let him go to his room, then.
Pardon, monsieur, into my chambre you wish for me to go, oui?
No need for that. Is there out?
Oh, so long as he's awake, I don't care, one way or another. Where's my salt? You know I can't start a day without my salt.
I know, dear. They're where you'd expect them to be, on the mantelshelf in their regular place.
Oh, yes, I forgot. If I may disturb you, monsieur.
Oh, but of course. The chair before the fire. Very nice, oui? Très charmant. When it is so very cold outside.
Oh, thanks. Bessie, that glass is here. Where's a tablespoon and some water?
Oh, I'll get them for you. Just a moment, dear.
Jules Gamache stood in the bay window and watched the little domestic scene. Occasionally, he riffled through his ever-present dictionary as if for a word to describe the events he was watching. Such inconsequential little events. Betty came trotting back from the kitchen with a tablespoon and a pitcher of water. She put them on the table alongside the salt and glass. Al measured his own dosage, poured it into the glass. Then he poured in the water. Almost mockingly, he raised his glass as if in a toast to the Frenchman standing nearby. Then down the contents of the glass.
Oh, those salts taste bitter this morning.
Yeah, they are never sweet, no?
Nothing sweet about them.
Then why complain, dear? You had more to drink than usual last night, so the salts taste more bitter than usual.
1 hour later.
Betty, get some help. Oh, it's the cramps. Oh, I can't stand it. I can't stand it. It's awful.
Oh, Jules, get a doctor. Call the cook. Do something.
I will try. My English, it is not good. Oh. No, but I will try.
Oh, my feet, they itch. They're driving me crazy. The pain and the itching.
Shortly thereafter, Alfie Brown was quite dead. And so the tragedy reached its climax. And playing its little part in that tragedy was a certain dictionary, which, as I've told you, can be seen today in the Black Museum. Dr. Westcott, the local physician, was called at once, but far too late. Alf Brown was past help. The doctor listened gravely to the story as Betty told it to him, while Jules stood by, the very picture of solicitude.
Oh, he went so quick, Doctor. And in such agony. Cramps and groans. And he said the strangest thing.
What was that, Mrs. Brown?
Well, he cried out with his feet were itching. It was almost lost, and he said...
Is that right, Mrs. Brown? Oui, Monsieur le Docteur, ça avait raison.
Well, if you say so, it's an interesting symptom. Peculiar one, particular poison. Though how this household will come by, I haven't the slightest idea.
Poison? But, Doctor, it was his sauce. Although he did complain that they tasted more bitter than usual.
Anything else, Mrs. Brown?
No, nothing else. Oh, I'm so upset. Confused. But what poison? How?
Itching feet, bitter taste, great pain, they all point to strychnine. But, of course, we won't be able to know for certain till there's been a post-mortem.
Oh, Doctor, why?
Well, I can't sign a certificate under these circumstances. I have to notify the coroner and the police.
Oh.
Now, I think our next precaution is for you to give me the bottle, the spoon and the glass into my charge. Where are they?
I don't quite... Mr. Gamache, do you remember?
Je ne sais pas, madame. Je ne comprends pas.
Oh, come, Mrs. Brown. Now, pull yourself together. You want to catch the party who poisoned your husband, don't you? Perhaps there was a better question than Dr. Wesk had realized. It was pure rhetoric at that moment, as far as he was concerned. Of course, the widow wanted to catch the murderer. Still, took a bit of concentrated prodding of Betty's memory until she said...
I know now, Doctor. I put them in the drawer of the kitchen table when I left Port Alfred for a moment to fetch some tea and soda. I thought it might help.
They found the bottle in the glass and the spoon in the kitchen table drawer. The doctor looked at them closely.
Someone's washed these thoroughly. There are still traces of water in the bottle and the glass. Mrs. Brown, I'm going to the police at once.
And Dr. Westcott went to the local police. The local police went to Scotland Yard. Betty Brown went to Jules Gamache.
You did it, Jules. I don't know how, but you did it.
Ma chérie, ma foi, impossible.
You did. You killed Alfred, and you stayed right there and watched him die.
Betty, you are most... you are most hysterical. You know I do not kill your Alfie. You must know this.
I know. I feel it in my bones. You killed him. Go away, Jules. Go away. I never want to see you again as long as I live.
Sadly, as if overwhelmed by the unpredictability of women, Jules Gamache packed his things and left the Binnacle Inn. But he didn't go far. Just to the next village and the next inn, there he waited and watched. Waited to hear from his beloved, now widowed, his Betty. Waited for developments in a case which the coroner's jury had labeled death at the hands of person or persons unknown. The developments were not long in coming.
My name is West, Mrs. Brown, Inspector West, Scotland Yard. And my credentials.
Yes, sir.
I have a few questions, particularly concerning the disposal of the poison.
I'll try to answer them, Inspector.
Do you know who washed out the bottle and glass?
No, I'm afraid I don't. I left them in the kitchen. We were all so upset by poor Alfie's suffering. We were rather hysterical, I'm afraid.
I understand. No idea on that. I see. Tell me, Mrs. Brown, have you ever used any kind of weed killer in the garden of this inn?
No, sir. Not that I know of.
Poison for rodents, rats, mice, and so on?
No, sir. We've never been troubled by such.
Have you any idea who might have wanted to kill your husband, Mrs. Brown?
No, I haven't.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Brown. If I should...
The inspector left the front of the house, so to speak, and visited below stairs. He had a nice talk with the cook over a cup of tea.
Mrs. Davis, did you wash out the salts bottle?
No, why should I? I've got enough work. And that was New Year's Day. The maid didn't come in. I had to clean up, too. Pity, not much of a New Year in this house.
Did you notice the bottle at all?
Oh, I remember saying to Mrs. Brown that there wasn't much more than a tablespoon left in it.
and perhaps she'd better order another bottle in case Mr. Brown was getting mad if he had none.
Now, this is important, Mrs. Davis. Can you place anyone at all, in this kitchen between the time Mrs. Brown brought the bottle in here and the time Dr. Westcott took it away?
No one but the Frenchman, sir.
Mr. Gomesh.
I seem to remember, sir. I wouldn't want to get him in no trouble unless he deserved it. But he did come in here and jabber at me. And then he used his little book.
Little book?
He's got a dictionary. Looks up the French and finds the English. Right comical he is sometimes.
I see. Then he looked in his dictionary.
And he said bottle. He said something else. I didn't pay much attention. I just pointed at the kitchen drawer.
Did he take the bottle out of the drawer?
I wouldn't know, sir. For all I know, he just wanted to be sure it was in a safe place. I heard him open and close the drawer, that was all. Then he went out.
Did he have a chance to put it back?
Lots of chances. I was that busy running in and out.
That's too bad. Oh, excellent tea, Mr. Davis.
The inspector was never a man to accept loose ends. He ran all his leads to earth. This is the approach which brought him finally to where Jules Gamache was staying.
Do you accuse me, Inspector?
Merely asking routine questions, Mr. Gamache. Did you have any reason to dislike or resent Mr. Brown?
None. No, but of course not.
Have you ever had any strychnine in your possession?
No, but pourquoi? Why should I?
I can't say, sir. I can only try to fill in the blank spaces. Someone, you see, gave Mr. Brown the opportunity to poison himself. That kind of gift is murder, Mr. Gamache.
Naturally.
I'm afraid I must ask you to remain in England, sir, until the case is closed.
But for me, this will be a pleasure. I assure you, Inspector, I wish to see vengeance on this murderer. I loved Mr. Brown almost as a brother.
Once, a smooth, blank wall for Scotland Yard to face and search for some crack somewhere. The interest in the case emmered down. Nothing was happening. Then the newspapers picked up a lead, something so fantastic, the men assigned to watch the Binnacle Inn and its neighborhood hardly believed their own ears. It seems that Jules Gamache began to write letters. And to the police.
There is one suspect who had not been questioned, a man long subject to Alfred Brown's whims and temper, the pot washer at the inn, known to me only as Georges. I point the finger of suspicion. Observe, gentlemen of Scotland Yard, the comings and goings of Monsieur Arthur Brookfield, solicitor to Madame Brown. This man is in and out of her residence at all hours. Certainly not all of this can be on business.
Was jealousy entering the picture now? The letters aroused a good deal of attention once they leaked to the newspapers, as such things have a way of doing. Jules Gamache was quite pleased when the reporters swarmed about him and the photographers took his picture. Many times, in many poses. This was fame, at last, for an impoverished inventor living on his wits.
Come in, sir. You asked to see me on the Brown case.
Yes, sir. My name is Scott, sir. I'm the owner of a chemist's shop in Woking.
Not too far from the Binnacle Inn, is it?
Just far enough to miss some of the news, but this morning I saw this newspaper.
Yes, our French friend. Do you know him?
He was a customer of mine a few weeks back, just before Christmas.
Go on, Mr. Scott.
He asked for strychnine.
Oh, what excuse did he give?
Oh, something about experiments in the wireless. He kept consulting a small English-French dictionary to express himself.
The wireless, yes, that's the new excuse. Although why they should think the wireless operations entail the use of poisons is beyond me. Did you sell him any?
I did. I made him sign the poison book. The name he used was Hatch.
Mr. Scott, do you think you can identify this man among a dozen others? Well, Mr. Scott?
That's he, sir.
The short fellow with the bright black eyes.
Thank you, mister.
Monsieur le chemiste. Bonjour, c'est un plaisir. How you say, one moment, please. Oui, ici. It is a pleasure that we meet again.
Jules Gamache, I have a warrant for your arrest on a charge of willful murder. I must warn you that anything you may say...
Well, that's the story. And today, the dictionary which played its part in that story can be found in its place in the Black Museum.
Orson Welles will be back with you in just a moment.
Truly a strange, impassioned little man, that Jules Gamache. He's half crazy, half sane. You wonder about him. And you know, to add to the dilemma of his personality, is one last point. While Jules was awaiting execution, he wrote another letter to Inspector West, stating that shortly after the death of Al Brown, he, Jules, saw a woman. Whether the woman was the cook or his beloved Betty, he didn't know, secrete something behind some loose bricks in the garden wall at the Binnacle Inn. Of course, the police investigated. They found two small jugs, one with crystalline strychnine in it, and the other with a solution of the same poison. Now, the question is, did Jules Gamache put those jugs there himself, or did one of the women? And if the latter, why did Gamache wait until just before his death to reveal this? Was it some odd form of gallantry? Well, I guess no one will ever know. And now until next time, till we meet in the same place and I tell you another story about the Black Museum, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
This is WDCB-FM, Glen Ellyn.
We hope you enjoyed these two episodes of The Black Museum with Orson Welles. If you did, please send us a review and share with friends. And you Spotify listeners, we appreciate comments as well. This is your host and storyteller, John Hagedorn. This is 1001 Ghost, Chiller, and Lovecraft Stories. Until next time, everyone. Stay safe, and we'll be back soon.